Hello, you're listening to The Music Mill, and I'm Mark Thompson, here with you for the next hour. Coming up in the next half hour, I'll be speaking to media expert Paul Blanchard about the changes that the government are currently planning to freedom of information. In particular, we'll be focusing on some comments that Conservative Minister Chris Grayling made about how FOI requests are apparently being abused, in quotes, by journalists. Paul is the presenter of the excellent Media Focus podcast, and it'll be good to get his take on this. And then later, we'll be joined by Lib Dem activist and former parliamentary candidate Kelly Marie Blundell to discuss how her party is now doing 6 months into the new parliament. With the number of MPs reduced from 57 to 8, are they still an effective force? Is the electorate perhaps starting to think they've had enough of a kicking and are starting to listen to them again? Well, we'll find out.
Contact Mark now. Tweet at Mark Reckons.
Yeah, if you want to get in touch, I'm on Twitter at Mark Reckons. You can tweet your thoughts about today's topics or anything else. You can also email me on markreckons@live.co.uk, either during the show or if you're listening to the podcast version, anytime. The first thing we're going to talk about in the first half hour is freedom of information. So this is something that, I tell you what, rather than me explain it, why don't I get my guests to give us a bit of a primer on what freedom of information is all about. I'm delighted to be joined by Paul Blanchard, who is the host of the excellent Media Focus podcast. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Mark. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me on.
No problem. Great to have you. Can you just fill us in on what freedom of information is and why, from your perspective, it's important before we get onto the substance of what the government is proposing to do about it?
Yeah, in a sense, that's a nightmare question, isn't it? Because I can quite happily opine on it, but now it becomes a memory test, as it were. But I'll do my best. FOI was brought in by Tony Blair's government, and it was a big initiative of the Labour Party when they got into government, frankly, because government departments could do whatever they liked, really, and weren't accountable to the people, because people at large, didn't even have the right to the information. They couldn't ask questions of their local council, government departments, and hold them to account, because if you don't literally know what they're doing right or wrong, and you don't have the facts at hand, then how can you hold them to account? So it was a central plank of openness and accessible government that Blair brought in. If you'll remember, very famously, when he was asked about his regrets toward the end of his premiership, he said that they'd perhaps gone too far, and echoing some of the sentiment that Grayling's saying at the moment, which I actually challenge Blair on, really, because I think this is one of the things that the Labour government can be most proud for, or proud of, I should say. It's brought in tons of shed the spotlight on tons of what government has been doing, right and wrong, and I think the country's hugely better for it, for a number of reasons. But there seems to be this opinion within government, espoused by Grayling at the moment, that it's just a kind of substitute for weak journalism, that journalists are kind of putting in these fishing expedition requests to say, well, just how many napkins are the DVLA buying, just so they can write a story that, you have to pay 5 pence more when you renew your licence because of the unbridled and unrestrained napkin buying habits of the executives of the DVLA. I mean, I jest and I exaggerate just for comedic effect, but this is what they're trying to say, really, is that FOI is just a substitute for poor journalism and actually isn't delivering any openness, and that absolutely and 100% is a complete misrepresentation of what FOI is about, both in practice and in principle.
Yeah, because I mean, should probably, before we get into the real substance of this debate, I mean, I largely agree with the people who are saying that, freedom of information is a very good thing, and if anything, it should go further rather than be constrained. But I think for the purposes of this discussion, it might get very boring if we just agree with each other. So I'm probably going to have to probe a little bit from a devil's advocate position. But before we get to that point, you've highlighted some of the stuff that Chris Grayling has been saying, and he has criticise the media for, as you say, kind of fishing expeditions. But Chris Grayling himself, when he was in opposition, submitted over 50 freedom of information requests, and used the information that he got from those questions, the answers that he got, as part of his campaigning as an opposition MP. So, if anyone knows how freedom of information works and works well for people who want to know what government's doing, it's Chris Grayling, isn't it?
I mean, I completely agree with you. The rank hypocrisy of Chris Grayling on a number of issues, genuinely flabbergasts me. You know, things that on things that he was doing, like prisoners' books and all this kind of thing. I mean, it's just I've just never. He just seems to be completely misguided and incompetent, which is somewhat irksome. But and yeah, the delicious irony of him campaigning and railing against FOI now when he's in government, when you know he's liberally used it himself to try and embarrass the government when he was out of power, I think is completely laughable. And actually, that to me nails down that you know the why FOI is such a good thing, because if government is allowing itself to give away information so that it can be attacked, then that to me is the mark of an open and, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say honest government, but a government that's trying to do its best to be as open and honest as possible, to the extent where it will even allow opposition politicians to ask it questions, it then gets the truth, so that information can then be used against it. And to me, that is the mark of an open and accountable government. I mean, FOI is something that we should cherish in this country, and I'm just completely flabbergasted that he would try and seek to restrain it. I hope, against hope, that he won't get away with it.
Yeah, I wonder if that might be a bit optimistic, though, Paul, really, because, I mean, I'm not sure the average person on the street would really even know what FOI is, and that maybe cuts to the core of what Grayling was actually arguing when he was saying that journalists go on fishing expeditions and that they're abusing FOI, because if journalists and the media are restricted in submitting FOI requests, then the only way that members of the public will be able to find out the information would be by submitting FOI requests themselves. But realistically, that hardly ever happens. And the media, I guess, in a way, on behalf of the general public, who probably, to a certain extent, are quite interested in some of the things that FOI requests reveal. I mean, The Guardian did quite a good public service a couple of weeks ago. They published 103 FOI stories that wouldn't have been possible to publish and to get the information about if it wasn't for freedom of information. And it's things like Clare's Law, 1,300 domestic abuse disclosures made, prison service spending £2,500 on a funeral for a child killer, driving test fraud, TfL boss charges taxpayers for 40-pound bottles of wine and meals at the Groucho, compensation paid out by police forces, and so on and so on. You know, there's lots and lots of stories listed there, and when I look through them, I think, well, actually, a lot of these are in the public interest. Whether, you know, I agree or disagree with the sentiment implied by the headlines in these stories is almost irrelevant, because it's shining a light, it's sunlight being the disinfectant, isn't it?
Of course it is. And I think it's ridiculous and disingenuous of Grayling to suggest that members of the public are just going to be the sole bastions here of openness in democracy because they're busy. You know, that is also why journalists have a job, because they hold government to account on behalf of the public. And indeed, you know, again, one of the great things about FOI is it's open to everyone, whether you be a journalist asking a question or a member of the public. You know, you can hold government to account, and you can't do that, as you've just said there, unless you know the facts, because sunlight is the best disinfectant. I mean, I've been active in politics for many, many years. I was elected on York Council for 6 years. I've stood for Parliament. I know that as a politician, you quite rightly fear public scrutiny, and I mean that in a kind of constructive sense, because you don't want to do anything that's wasteful or improper, quite apart from the ethics, because the practicality, of course, is that with a robust FOI regime like this, you're going to get found out, which is why, you know, the threat of that sunlight, as it were, as you say, being the best disinfectant, actually means that government, therefore, I think, feels a greater pressure to conduct itself you know, in a more appropriate way. And that filters down right through to where there are incredibly wasteful things. As you've quite rightly said, it's not corruption on the part of ministers or anything like that. It's more about wasting unnecessarily taxpayers' money in the quangos and in the departments. And FOI is really good at bringing that to light and minimising it. So, I mean, for him to say that FOI costs money is insanity, frankly. It saves taxpayers money because it forces governments, fearing that scrutiny, to be as frugal as possible, and rightly so.
Yeah, I mean, it feels a little bit like some of this stuff that they're talking about here is in the end a bit silly, because, you know, if they're saying that journalists and the media are not going to be able to submit requests, well, I heard Susie Boniface, who's also known as Fleet Street Fox, she was being interviewed recently, and she said that she never submits FOI requests in her own name. She always she has a sequence of about four or five different pseudonyms that she'll rotate and use, because she knows if she submits it herself, she'll just get the runaround anyway, and it'll take months and months to get the answer. And absolutely. So she just pretends to be someone else. So in the end, any journalist who wants to submit an FOI request will either use a pseudonym or get a friend who isn't a journalist to submit it. So all this will do is just add another slight hurdle that journalists will have no problem vaulting anyway, surely.
I agree. I mean, it's exactly like prisoners' books, really. The whole thing just seems cooked up for a storm in a teacup reason. He's not thought it through. I don't think he'll get away with it, and then he'll move on to the next blunder. And the only reason why we have to be robust is if we're not, then he might accidentally, through no skill of his own, get away with it. And of course, he can't. It's one of these things. I mean, I read The Week, the magazine The Week, and it's a really interesting read. But one of the columns is called Boring But Important. And I think that FOI, in this sense, you know, falls under that, because, you know, it's not the most exciting of topics. In a sense, it's only of interest to kind of politicos and legal types like me and you. But actually, in an open and honest society, it's incredibly important that we have a robust FOI regime. Journalists have to be able to do this because it's saving taxpayers money and increasing the openness and accountability of government. I mean, how is this? How can anyone argue against this? It's just insane. I mean, you just said at the beginning of our conversation, as we went on air, that, you know, you'd have to play devil's advocate because you'd have to, you know, you kind of agree with me. Well, I mean, who isn't off their rocker wouldn't agree with us?
Right, challenge accepted then. So I was actually going to move on to the devil's advocate stuff now, because we've agreed with each other too much, I'm afraid. So, therefore, OK, well, let's slightly unpack what you said near the start, which was that Tony Blair said that that's one of the things that he most regretted about his time in office, and Jack Straw as well, who was the politician who actually piloted the legislation for the original Freedom of Information through the Commons when he was Home Secretary, also is now a sceptic about Freedom of Information. Now, Tony Blair and Jack Straw are very intelligent people, and there are other people who have been in government or are in government now who also think that FOI is not a good thing. And that must come, at least in some respect, from a position that could be defended intellectually. I'm not saying Grayling has done a very good job of that, but I think there is a case that could be made. And the case surely would be along the lines of, government is better when people behind closed doors can speak freely and have a robust internal debate and come to decisions, and not have all the internal workings of what happened all leaked out in the press. So isn't there an argument for saying that freedom of information is all well and good, but actually there do need to be safeguards in place so that government can be executed in the best interests of all of us? And sometimes that requires things to not be revealed.
In some ways, I agree with you. I think government has to, when it's deciding policy, has to be able to have a full and frank discussion internally and, you know, explore different options and avenues of thought. And, you know, that needs to be done in private. I accept that, because if you don't, then you're going to get, the opposite, which is an incredibly risk-averse culture where government is fearful of innovating or saying the wrong thing, and then we're never going to make any progress. And I do see that around the boards of some businesses that I work with from time to time, is that, you know, if there's a culture of, you know, people don't get anything wrong, then also that means that it stifles the agility of the business and stifles innovation, because people would rather, you know, shut up and say nout and be thought a fool, as Dennis Thatcher once said, than speak up and remove all doubts. I think there is that. There is a serious issue there that, of course, that has to be done. But it has to be proportional. And I think that's where it becomes you know, very, very important, because there should be FOI and freedom of information on the right kinds of things, in terms of outcomes, in terms of the measurement of what the government is actually doing, but allow it the freedom to make the decisions and explore the avenues in a kind of confidential manner. And as I mean, we have a robust Information Commissioner's Office here as well. So, you know, if there is any disputes as to FOI, it's natural that the government would try to occasionally refuse FOI requests. And an independent arbiter of whether a request is reasonable and can be fulfilled in a timely and costly manner is something that we ought to have, and indeed do have. And I also think, you know, if answering an FOI request does require millions of pounds and it's a ridiculous question, then of course there should, you know, that shouldn't be allowed. But on the other hand, 99.9% of requests are perfectly reasonable and perfectly answerable. And as you know, as long as though the government has a legitimate reason to refuse that, then they should. But if it's just that they might find it mildly embarrassing, then no, they shouldn't be able to allow to do that. And I also think that this is a question of, you know, getting used to the openness of the FOI provides as a society, because you know, nowadays the initial stories that you got under FOI have kind of gone, really. They've been done. It's the stuff that FOI reveals now is the stuff it ought to be revealing, you know. And I do kind of think this is a bit like, I was speaking with a journalist a couple of weeks ago, and he said that FOI was a bit like drunken pictures on Facebook, actually, that at first everyone thought that it was something that had to be covered up, that it was, you know, every picture was newsworthy. And now, you know, 5 years later, no one really cares about that. In fact, it's odd if you don't. So I think it's a bit like that with FOI, because all of the kind of initial stuff that was done to embarrass government has already been done. I don't think it's journalistically interesting. But if it is journalistically interesting now, then that thing, that, to me, that smacks of serious wrongdoing or serious issue, and it's right that it should be highlighted.
Yeah. I mean, I think the... Well, there is a commission, isn't there, that is looking at this question now. Although I did see that Jack Straw is one of the people who's been appointed, so that's quite good for the government, because they can say, well, look, we've appointed someone from Labour, but someone from Labour who, although piloted the original legislation, is on record as saying he doesn't like it and he wants to restrict it. And I think the various other people who are on the commission are all of a similar ilk, so I don't think it's going to be a huge shock when the commission reports and decide, and makes recommendations to restrict things, which, I mean, you were just talking about Facebook and the internet and so forth. And I mean, just from trying to look at this from a kind of objective perspective, it would seem a little bit strange for the government to be going in the direction of hiding more things and covering things up when everything else in society is moving more towards being open and sharing information and so on and so forth. It does seem like a slightly strange position for the government to take, I guess.
I think they think they can get away with it, which is the problem. You know, the whole austerity agenda, government saying, well, this is about saving money, it's not about making us more less open. And people just go, yeah, whatever. You know, we haven't managed to whip up a frenzy about this. I mean, I present a media podcast, as you know, and I've had a lot of journalists on it talking about this. But we, you know, in this campaign, the Press Gazette are running a campaign, and there's a few places, people that are kind of getting together on it. But it doesn't seem to have been as impactful as it could have been, frankly, because, you know, as you said earlier, it's just not sexy, is it? It's just something that I think people think, well, you know, we're not really that bothered about it, which is a shame, really. But, you know, we're not going to give up the fight, really. This is something that's important. It's worth fighting for. You know, we're going to do our best to resist it.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think I've made my position pretty clear as well. Maybe you need a hashtag and, you know, some kind of proper kind of campaign push behind it. But like you say, it's not something perhaps the average person in the street knows that much about, but hopefully we've helped to enlighten some listeners who maybe weren't so aware of what was going on. Just while we've got you on, Paul, because I know you're very well connected within the Labour Party, and you used to be an advisor, and also you were a councillor. I just wondered.
You used to be well connected, I think. I think you can't use present continuous tense with my connection to the Labour Party. I know quite a few people, but none of them are of any use now, I think.
All right, well, fair enough. But maybe that kind of brings me on to just the last thing, while we've got you on for a few minutes. I mean, what do you think about Jeremy Corbyn and the position that the Labour Party is now in?
Oh, I can't. I'm reminded of when, you know, you used to read the Sunday newspapers and the reporters would go into, you know, a bordello or whatever, and they'd say, you know, the owner of the bordello used language it's not suitable for a family newspaper. I always used to remember that. we're up a certain creek without a certain paddle, really. Let me start with the positives, really. I think Jeremy Corbyn is a nice person. I don't think he's evil. I think he has sincerely held beliefs that come from a position of honour and a position of thought. And actually, none of his beliefs are ridiculous or, you know, he's a man worthy of deep respect. And I'm actually quite humbled by him because, you know, he's stuck around Parliament for all those decades, has thought his opinions through, holds them from a deeply held point of principle, and you know, clearly is a very serious, very thoughtful man. I also think he's very honourable as well. I would trust him, you know, in terms of his personal trustworthiness and his honour, sense of honour. You know, I think there's a lot of positives there. And bizarrely, for a Blairite that I am, I actually agree with him on certain issues like the abolition of Trident. I also think that he's certainly helped reframe the debate on lots of different issues, and also take the kind of ridiculous toxic situation we've got into with the way that the media reports politics, you know, so that if any politician or MP thinks aloud or says something that is slightly different from the party line, that it's construed as a gaffe or as rebellion and all this. And we've got our knickers in a knot here as a society, with the media and politicians kind of robustly set against each other. And it manifests itself in the kind of gladiatorial combat that you get on the Today programme. And I actually applaud the fact that Jeremy Corbyn is doing a lot to kind of change that. I don't think we can go back now to this Punch and Judy thing, as Cameron said. And my view, deep down, is, you know, all power to his elbow. I quite welcome the fact that he's been elected, and I hope he makes a difference. As long as, though, he buggers off in a couple of years, and maybe we get someone who is electable, like Dan Jarvis.
Yeah, but isn't the problem, though, Paul, that, I mean, if he either chooses to bugger off or is buggered off by the rest of the party, that all that's likely to happen is that John McDonnell or someone else from the hard left will be elected in his place, because the composition of the membership of the Labour Party is now so different from what it was even 6 months ago, that the fact that Corbyn could win with 60% of the vote on the first round, and he won, I think it was 49.7% of existing members, so although that wasn't a majority, another round of counting and he would definitely have got more than 50%, even if it was just the pre-existing members who'd been there before the election. So everything's changed, and the idea that Dan Jarvis or Tristram Hunt or Chuka Munna can now win the leadership is for the birds, isn't it?
Yes, in short. And that's why I'm depressed, because much as I'd like him to kind of shuffle off in a couple of years, having changed things, you know, and someone like Dan come in, I don't think that's going to happen realistically with my reality hat on, as it were. I think that, but as a Democrat, you know, I can't argue with the size of Corbyn's mandate. What I can argue with is the rule changes that Ed Miliband brought in, and with the Collins review that says that people can join, you know, for a political party for £3. I mean, it just makes it easy to hijack. When I first joined the Labour Party 20-odd years ago, I couldn't even vote for my local council candidate until I'd been a member for a year. And now...
Interestingly, you're saying that, because in the selection for the... Is it Alderman Royton, where the MP... what was his name? Who just recently died. Michael Meacher. It was reported that the members in the local party had to have been members for at least 6 months. So no one who had joined the party since the election could vote for the candidate for the Alderman Royton by-election. And yet all of those people were able to join for £3 and only joined like the day before, and could then vote for Jeremy Corbyn for the leader of the party. That seems to be structurally very odd.
I'm a big fan of Jim McMahon, actually, and I'm really glad that he was selected to, you know, be our by-election candidate. He's a good guy, and he's done a fantastic job on Oldham Council. I have quite a few friends who know him very well, and I hear very, very good things about him. I've had a little bit of dialogue with him directly, but not a lot, really. I wouldn't say I know him well. But I also agree with you that I don't think he would have even got selected had that rule change got through. Because, I mean, this is the thing. You can whip up a Twitter storm in seconds now, and £3 is no barrier if you want to very quickly mobilise 200,000 people, you know, to vote for someone. So I think that it was, that in a sense, we've made a rod for our own back here, changing the rules with the Corbyn, with the Collins review, because it allows, you know, these kind of Twitter mobs to hijack things very, very easily. I mean, I'm minded of, you know, when Radio 2, with the whole kind of Jonathan Ross, Andrew Sachs thing, you know, in the old days, you'd get like 40, 50 complaints, and now with the Daily Mail can whip up 100,000 complaints in seconds. So we need kind of filter mechanism, protection mechanisms against these Twitter mobs. Otherwise, we're always going to get them hijacking the party.
The thing is, though, there was a protection mechanism for, you know, to try and make sure that someone who couldn't command a decent proportion of the parliamentary Labour Party. And that protection mechanism was the nomination threshold of 35 or more MPs. And Corbyn wasn't going to get 35 nominations, but some MPs who had no intention of voting for him lent him nominations to get him on the ballot for a wider debate.
Well, they did that because for the same reason that they nominated Diane Abbott back in the day, because they thought they had no chance. I mean, what had changed between now and then is the £3 membership, and no one foresaw this. It's in hindsight, it's obvious that this could have happened, but I didn't see it at the time. I thought, I actually thought, well, I don't really want, someone on the left poisoning the debate, really, because I I'm a big supporter of like Dan Hodges' position and always have been, but he wrote a piece at the time that said, look, and even he didn't think Corbyn could win at this point, and he said, look, this isn't about a student society politics debate. We have those kind of debates in the policy form. This is about who we're electing for the leader of the Labour Party, and someone who is not a credible leader shouldn't be on the ballot in the first place. And I actually thought that that was a fair point, so I objected to Corbyn being on the ballot in the first place. And then, as you've seen, that these MPs lending Corbyn their vote, many of whom, as you know, have said that they regret it since, have got him on the ballot, and then suddenly there's a Twitter mob joining the party for £3, which is no barrier at all. I mean, that needs to change. That needs to go completely. Means that we've now got an unelectable leader of the Labour Party, and this is my biggest problem, right, is that people who criticise me as a Blairite say, oh, power at all costs and blah, blah, blah. It's not that at all. It's about what if you've got to be in politics to do things. And the problem with all of these lefties that, elect people like Corbyn means that we have the Conservatives in power running the country and not us. And that, to me, is what's unforgivable on their part. It's just posturing. Anyone can lead be the leader of the opposition. What I want is someone who people can vote for to be Prime Minister so that we can actually get into power and do things. And I agree. I mean, my final thought on this, Mark, I felt this tension. You talk about the membership of the Labour Party, but even before all these so-called three-pounders joined, I felt that even when I was a councillor, because I was a bit of a Blairite, but all of the people, all of my fellow Labour councillors in York, were all basically saying, well, look, we've done the deal with the devil with Tony. It'll all be better when Gordon gets back in. We've done just enough to elect someone like him just so we can get in. And, but we really want someone truly of the left. And I just thought they don't get it, because the minute we go back to something like that, we then go back into opposition. I mean, I remained silent when Gordon Brown was Prime Minister because we had to be, quote-unquote loyal. But I knew we were sleepwalking to disaster. Most reasonable members of the party knew that. We then, of course, lose the election. The first opportunity Gordon has to be tested by the electorate, they boot him out within seconds, right? They didn't even want David Cameron as Prime Minister, which is why we had a coalition, because they weren't quite sure enough about him. But the one thing they were sure about is they didn't want Gordon. And then what do? We elect Ed Miliband as our leader. And then again have this so-called loyalty where we can't question him for 5 years. And then what do they do? I mean, again, one thing that the electorate was certain of is that they didn't want Ed Miliband as their Prime Minister, but they've been consistently saying that to the pollsters for 5 years. When are the Labour Party going to wake up? So here we are now. As you've just said, the party are even worse in that sense, that we've elected someone even more to the left. I have no idea what's going to happen to the party after the next election, because we are certainly going to lose. And at some point, we're going to get back our desire for power. And then at that point, hopefully, we'll elect someone that I hope we haven't got rid of them all and deselected them all, because at that point, like we did when Blair took over, we'll choose a leader that's actually going to get us back into government.
Paul, it's been great having you. I'd love to talk to you for longer, but we are going to have to move on.
A bit of a rant, that, wasn't it? Sorry,
Mark. No, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. How can people get hold of you, get in touch with you, Twitter and so forth?
Yeah, if people want to follow me on Twitter, it's at Paul W. R. Blanchard. And if you want to listen to the podcast that I present, please do. It's free and it's at mediafocus.org.uk.
I can highly recommend it, and especially I can highly recommend the Media Masters series that's part of that podcast, where you have long form interviews with people who are at the top of the media game, people like Jeremy Vine. That was one that particularly stood out. But you've had all sorts of guests on over the last year or two on that, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. I had Linton Crosby on it a few weeks ago.
Absolutely.
And he did his interview, so that was quite a coup.
That was a real coup. That was a really good one, too. Paul, it's been great to have you on. It'd be great to have you back at some point.
Pleasure. Be delighted to.
Cheers. Good stuff. Thanks. That's Paul Blanchard, who is the presenter of the Media Focus podcast.
Mark Thompson on Music Mill FM.
Yes, Mark Thompson here with you for about the next 22 minutes. The next thing we're going to talk about is the Lib Dems. So it's now 6 months or so since the general election, when the party went from 57 MPs to 8 MPs. I should just declare interest. I did used to be a member of the Lib Dems, as I have mentioned on this show before, but I left the party a couple of years ago. But I'm now joined by Kelly Marie Blundell, who was the parliamentary candidate for the Lib Dems for Guildford at the last election and is still very active in the party now. Hi, Kelly Marie.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for coming on. What's your feeling about how the party is actually doing now, say, 6 months on? I mean, you know, what's the feeling like on the ground? And you recently had a conference as well, didn't you? So what was the feeling from the members?
I would say that the feeling is overwhelmingly positive, all things considered. We've certainly seen a rapid increase in membership, an increase of almost a third in our membership since the May election. And even better on the ground, we're winning by-elections at council level across the country, which is really, really positive. And with all of the new members and with Tim Farron as our new leader, there's a really big push to a Lib Dem fight back and a rebuilding of our party.
Did you vote for Tim Farron?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Okay, so you presumably think he is the right leader and he's a better leader than Norman Lamb would have been?
I like both Tim and Norman a great deal. I feel that Tim was the person who inspired me in the party and really who I felt would inspire the whole party to rebuild from the grassroots upwards.
I mean, the reason I ask is because there are some, in fact, there are quite a lot of people, admittedly most of these people are probably not in the party, but plenty of commentators I've seen say, and I've wondered myself, whether if the party had have known that Jeremy Corbyn was going to be Labour leader, do you think Norman Lamb would have had a better chance? Because he was seen as more of a kind of centrist, more, I mean, he was a minister in the coalition government, for example, and he might have been better place to position the Lib Dems in the centre ground than Tim Farron, who is, for a Lib Dem, fairly left-wing, isn't he?
I think that the Lib Dems are, on the whole, a centre-left party. I think that there are some that would argue that Norman was seen very much as a member of the coalition, a member of the centre of the central ground of the Lib Dems, and in that respect he may make an interesting, or may have made an interesting competitor. But I still think that Tim Farron is standing up for things and building his presence and rebuilding the party from the ground up.
OK. I remember at the conference a few weeks ago, Tim Farron made a speech. And within that speech, he didn't really seem to be distancing himself very much from what happened in the coalition. And that slightly surprised me. He almost seemed to be trying to own quite a lot of what happened with the coalition. And the reason that struck me as odd is because there are a lot of people who voted for the Lib Dems in 2010 who then didn't vote for the Lib Dems in 2015.
Yeah.
And a lot of those people are the sort of voters that the Lib Dems need to win back in order to be able to get a decent number of seats at the next election. So without putting some kind of decent, clear yellow water, I guess the phrase would be, between the position of the Lib Dems now and what happened in the coalition, it makes it very difficult to win those people back, because things like tuition fees, like tax cuts for millionaires, I mean, you don't need me to list all the policies.
No, I don't. But I have to be honest, though, Mark. I mean, I would be lying if I said I was against the coalition. I remain convinced that going into coalition was the right thing to do. And when you see what the Conservatives have done without the Lib Dem influence in the mere 6 months since the general election, you can actually see how much the Liberal Democrats actually did do in coalition to prevent the things that we're seeing, like the cuts to tax credits, like the snoopers charter. And I think that it's right that we stand up and we own that role. I think that we did get a lot of bad press for a lot of things. And Tim may well have behaved in a way that we do have to own the coalition, and I think that that's the right thing to do. That's not to say that I agree with everything the coalition did, but I think that we had some very hard choices to make. And there were a certain number of issues that people objected to on principle. I mean, Tim, for example, himself voted against the tuition fees rise, and that was something that definitely caused us as a party a lot of slack. However, that doesn't mean that the coalition was wrong in principle, and I think that it was the right thing for the country.
But on the doorstep in 2020, when you're talking to prospective Lib Dem voters and you're trying to persuade them of why they should vote Lib Dem, isn't it going to be pretty self-defeating to try and argue that, well, back in 2010 we stopped this and back in 2011 we stopped that. And that's not really a recipe for winning people over, is it, to say, well, look, you know, we did a job of stopping the Tories from implementing maybe a third or half of what they would have liked to, and look, they, it's, you know, in the current parliament in 2015 to 2020 they were able to implement all this other stuff. You require a much more positive message about why people should vote for Lib Dem. And isn't that part of, wasn't that part of the problem with the 2015 campaign, that Nick Clegg explicitly said, we will give a heart to the Tories and a head to Labour? He was saying, you know, we will moderate either of the two bigger parties. That's not a recipe for success, is it?
I'm not going to disagree that some of the messaging in 2015 wasn't brilliant. I think it was very difficult. But I think that we have a lot of radical policies and we think we have a lot to offer the voters. I mean, just looking at some of the things on refugees, we as a party seem to be the only party that are standing up for the refugees. Tim has been out to Lesbos. He was talking about it again today, where another 15 people have drowned off the coast of Greece. And no other party is actually going out there and saying, no, this is unacceptable. We have to do something about this. So I do think that as a party, we do have things that we can offer people. And actually, now we're free of the coalition constrictions, if you wish, we can be a lot louder about the things that we're standing up for.
So what do you think is the distinctive Lib Dem message that's starting to emerge with the new leadership and the fact that the party's now in opposition?
I think largely it's about freedom for people, freedom for individuals. And ultimately, being a Liberal and being a Liberal Democrat is about freedom in that respect. For example, the proposed snoopers charter, where they want to give everyone control of our mobile phones and monitor all of our internet data, that breaches personal freedoms and individual freedoms. And these are the sort of messages that we're trying to shout about and get out there and say, no, this is wrong, fundamentally wrong, and anything that impinges on individual freedoms must be stopped. And I think that's a very strong message that is running through what the Lib Dems are saying.
Yeah. I mean, do you think, though, that having 8 MPs just puts you in a position where for the next 4.5 years you're just going to really struggle to be heard at all? I mean, for example, it's now the SNP that gets the two questions every week at Prime Minister's Questions, rather than the leader of the Lib Dems, as, you know, all the previous leaders, Nick Clegg
and
those
before. And,
of course,
that has had an impact on our position at Prime Minister's Question Time. And actually, going back to refugees, when Tim asked his question last week on the number of unaccompanied children and would we make provisions in Britain for them, David Cameron sought to make a nasty joke about the Liberal Democrats.
Yeah.
I mean, what sort of response is that to something that is incredibly important?
No, I agree with that. I mean, maybe I would say that, wouldn't I? Because I used to be a Lib Dem, and I still, you know, I still consider myself a fellow traveller with you know, a lot of the membership of the party, if not some of what the leadership might have done in the last few years. Mm-hmm. And I agree. I think that was completely out of order.
I think that the Lib Dems, certainly on the ground, are going back to what we are incredibly good at, which is community politics. And that can be whether you're standing up for individuals in the local council or protecting local services and actually getting communication out in different ways. So we, pre-coalition, were pretty used to the newspapers 90% of the time ignoring us, even with 42 MPs. I'd say we're still having quite a big splash for only having 8. And we're certainly seeing Tim Farron, Tom Brake in the news again today. And they do continue to build headlines, and we are still having an impact. Yes, that's not to say that losing a great deal of our MPs hasn't had a detrimental impact, but I do think that we can rebuild.
I mean, you mentioned about, you know, ground campaigning and getting your message across.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, say 10, 15 years ago, if a by-election had been called, you know, due to the death of an MP,
mm-hmm.
depending on exactly where it was, but it often didn't matter where it was, the Lib Dems would just flood into the seat, they would have a really good go, and in some cases they would pull off spectacular victories, or if not, have a really good run and maybe come a close second and then build a good base for maybe the next general election.
Yes.
That doesn't seem to be happening in Alderman Royton, where the by-election...
Actually, I have been completely bombarded with messages to go and support Jane Brophy, who's the candidate there and is a good friend of mine, and we've got busloads of people going up all the time, and there's been a number of telephone calling going on across the country for Jane as well. And so, well, certainly I was at a drinks evening recently for new members, and Tim was there and said, actually, no, we are going to stand up and we are going to fight every by-election that comes along. And I am seeing the people heading up to Oldham even this weekend. And I do think that we will turn that around and come back to campaigning, no matter what the by-election is, turning out the Phoenix flag.
Because at the moment it looks like a two-horse race between Labour and UKIP, and UKIP, if anyone's going to run Labour close, it would be UKIP. The Lib Dems don't really seem to be figuring at all, at least in the polls.
It's a rather strange perception that's being painted, isn't it? Because UKIP, for all their popularity, suddenly dropped off the charts in the general election and only managed to retain one of their two MPs.
Well actually, they didn't really drop off the charts, though, did they? I mean, they got 13% of the vote. It's only because of the electoral system that they got one MP. I mean,
but they were polling at 20% at some points in the year before. Mm. And certainly dominating the headlines. I think that there's a false debate being set there that it's between Labour and UKIP, but I think that it's a very interesting seat, but it has been solid Labour for a long time. Michael Meacher was a very well-respected MP, and I think that there'll be a great deal of people who are very sad about the loss, but that's not to say that it is a two-horse race, even at this stage. I think that there is a lot that can of inroads that can be made by the Lib Dems in that area.
Right, so you think there's actually a good chance that the Lib Dems could get a decent showing there then and increase their vote significantly?
I certainly think we can increase the vote share. I certainly think that we will put in all the efforts we can as well to do so.
OK, all right. Well, obviously, we'll keep an eye on that then. OK, well, Kelly Marie Blundell, it's been great to have you on. Thanks very much for your time tonight.
Yeah. Much, Mark, and hopefully speak to you soon.
So that's Kelly Marie Blundell, who is a Lib Dem activist and was a parliamentary candidate in Guildford at the general election. I'm Mark Thompson, and we've been talking about freedom of information and also the Lib Dems. But last week we had Joe Fidgin on, who is a presenter on Analysis on Radio 4. And we were talking about the ethics of meat eating, which was the basis of a programme that she'd broadcast a couple of weeks ago. And I thought it was a very interesting discussion. We've actually had some correspondence on this from someone describing themselves as Millennium Dome. It's quite a long email, but I'm going to read it anyway. It says, on the morality of eating the meat issue, you raised the issue of whether there would still be millions of cows existing if we didn't farm to eat them. But I thought rather quickly dismissed that. But then you presented a utilitarian argument about how long a cow would live if it lived out its life. And you were trying to balance out years of cow happiness against human happiness. But if we didn't eat cows, with the best will in the world, we'd have very many fewer cows, not least because if we were to grow a whole lot more veg and grain, we'd need the land currently grazed by the cattle. So the two arguments ought to be linked. There are currently 10 million cows in the UK, and about 2 million of them are dairy cows. Beef cows are sent to slaughter after about 2 years, dairy cows after about five. So that's 26 million cow years of just being alive. The natural lifespan of a cow being 20 to 25 years, that would be the equivalent of having slightly more than a million wild cows. I'll try not to judge cow happiness. It's not all one-sided. Fewer than 20% of British cows are intensively farmed, and domestication provides benefits too, e.g. available food, protection from predators, etc. So the question is, would or even could we allow a million cows to roam the UK in the wild or as pets? Well, apparently there are already about 2 million deer living wild in the UK. Let's just ignore whether deer and wild cows would be in competition for food. So in the end, I have to concede it's not impossible. And that's an interesting perspective. It wasn't something I'd particularly thought about when we were having the debate, but it's great to get people's views on this. So, as I've said, I'm at Mark Reckons on Twitter, and you can email me, markreckons@live.co.uk. Also, if you're listening to this live or you're listening to it as the podcast, because I do actually upload these as podcasts as well, and you can see them on my blog, which is markreckons.blogspot.co.uk, or you can just search for Mark Thompson's blog. I'll be back next week with more guests and more discussion, topical and sometimes not so topical.